surf is brightening up your days to make you think of sun and surf instead of the cloudy day that it is. And up next, we're going to have... I'm going to leave you with one from the Coffin Cats. This is the title track off of their album Forever for Hire from Stomp Records. This one came out very early last year before Coffin Cats switched record labels to Sailor Grave Records. And so here you have it. That's it for the Wrecking Hours. I'll see you tomorrow night at Smalls for the Three Bad Jacks show, doors at 8. And catch me Thursday for the return of the Rockabilly Psychabilly Thursdays at Small. I'll be spinning for a cool show with Doomstown. And that's it for the Wrecking Hours. Coffin Cats up. Title track, Forever for Hire.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
And we really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is really very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click on the Donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mill Valley Public Library, just north of San Francisco. The library is celebrating 100 years as this community's intellectual center.
Our thinking originates at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner on that lovely campus. That's about an hour and a half south of here. And at Stanford, Ken and I are both professors of philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're asking, what is love?
Ken, you're in love. I'm in love. Most people are in love or have been in love or will be in love. There have been countless great movies about love, poems about love, stories about love, songs about love. So you'd think we'd all know what love is, but we don't seem to. For every book that's been written with a love story, somebody has written a song about not knowing what love is, the mysteries of love. As Cole Porter famously asked, what is this thing called love?
Now, love is often portrayed as a powerful force, something that can inspire greatness in the lover and the beloved.
Or something that can make you act like a fool.
Love can be the greatest feeling in the world, but it can also be absolutely devastating when it doesn't work out. There are zillions of songs about love and heartbreak and loss, and if you listen to those songs, John, you might wonder why we ever love at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, love makes people do all kinds of crazy things. It leads to lots of heartache and pain. Basically, from a philosophical point of view, it seems like a completely irrational emotion.
I grant you, John, that love can sometimes be irrational, but love has its reasons, too. I mean, look, take my wife. There's all kinds of cool things about my wife. She's kind, she's intelligent, she's beautiful, she's funny, she laughs at my joke. And those give me reasons to love her. On the other hand, if I love somebody who is mean and stupid and boring and wouldn't laugh at my jokes, well, that would be irrational. But so look, I have lots of great reasons for loving my wife, which right there, QED shows that love is sometimes rational.
Isn't your wife a librarian?
She is indeed.
Well, there's a big reason right there. But still, I wonder, Ken, do you really love your wife for those reasons? I mean, sure, those are all good things, but wasn't it more like this? You fell in love with Claire, and then you came up with these reasons to justify your emotion? I guess it's kind of a chicken and egg question. Do we love first and then find reasons to justify it? Or do we see the reasons first and then talk ourselves into falling in love?
Oh, you know, it's kind of tricky. Anybody who, look, imagine somebody says, okay, should I love her or should I not? Okay, on the one hand, she's X, Y, Z, and, you know, on the other hand, these are the reasons not to love her. You might think, well, that sounds more like choosing a mule than choosing a partner. That's kind of cold and calculate. I would not call that love.
It paints a picture that just doesn't fit with experience. We don't rationally deliberate and decide who to love and then work on falling in love. That's, for most people, that's just not how the experience goes.
On the other hand, look, I told you all those good qualities about my wife, Claire, and those qualities make sense of my loving her. So even if I didn't decide to love her, it makes sense. It makes rational sense that I love her. So there's at least a kind of rationality to love, don't you think?
Well, I don't doubt that love has causes and that a person's particular qualities are part of the cause of why some other person comes to love that person. But I don't think it follows that love is rational. I mean, an avalanche has causes too, or an earthquake. And those causes can explain why it happened, but that doesn't make an avalanche rational.
You know, okay, I take your point. You know, that shows we got a lot to talk about here. Love's a complicated thing. What exactly is it? Why do we love? Are we just caused to love, or do we have reasons to love? Do we decide to love, or does it just happen to us? Is it ever rational? Maybe. Would we be better off without it sometimes?
And we've just been talking about romantic love. There's all kinds of other love. You can love your friends, your children, your country, your local library. You can also love abstract things like justice, beauty, truth, wisdom.
Which raises even more questions, John. All those different forms of love that you just talked about, is there something they have in common? And which kind of love contributes most to a well-lived life?
We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, in search of some truly epic love stories. And she came back and files this report.
What is love? Here are two real-life love stories, one of love found, the other of love lost. At first glance, Peter Libby and Mary Lekanesky seem like opposites. She's tiny, he's hulking. Mary says they were immediately drawn to each other, and things were going really well for a while.
Romantic, serious, my daughter was going to go to college, what were we going to do next? We were enjoying each other's company, this is the part I'm going to start crying.
And then in January, Peter's heart burst. His aorta tore from his heart to his left leg. As he was losing consciousness, he made a phone call, not for an ambulance, but to Mary. Peter could feel his life ebbing. He knew he was dying. Mary went to his house right away. He collapsed. She called 911. At the hospital, the first priority was to keep him alive and repair his aorta, then to try to save his left leg.
Then will he wake up? Because he had been iced and out. And if he wakes up, what cognitive function will he have? It was grim.
Peter's heart stopped for 54 minutes. After hours of surgery and against all odds, he woke up. And in those first few moments, he didn't know he had died.
You couldn't tell by looking at me, but I was happy. I was happy to see Mary.
It would be a slow recovery, and being uninsured, Peter would accumulate more than $800,000 in medical debt. He told Mary to leave him.
I said, you didn't sign up for this. You didn't sign up for a guy that is broken.
But of course, she didn't leave. And several months later, they were married.
Dying and coming back, it made me think, okay, what's important? And the most important thing in the world to me is Mary. There's nothing that even comes close. I came back from the dead to be with her.
On a trip to Chile in 2008, Amber Nelson met her fiancé, Adolfo Ignacio Celedón Bravo, or Fito as he's called. She hardly spoke Spanish, his English was terrible. They communicated through gesture. They ended up traveling through South America together. She remembers one drive in particular.
I asked him to pull over, and there's this just perfect little outlet to the lake. And the lake was so big, it looked almost like the ocean, and the sun was just setting. And both of us just tore off our clothes and jumped in the lake.
She was supposed to stay for just a few weeks, but ended up staying for 9 months.
I don't think I will ever reach that amount of happiness, active happiness of living right there in the moment again.
Eventually, Amber returned to the U.S. Despite the distance, their commitment grew. Amber describes it as a consuming, important love. Time passed, they got engaged. More time passed, Fito moved to Berkeley to be with Amber. The night before Fito's 35th birthday, Amber threw him a party. She took him out dancing, and they walked home in the pre-dawn hours. They kissed.
Even as we were having that kiss, I said to myself, this is the best kiss we've ever had. And it ended up being our last.
That night, Amber and Fito were robbed at gunpoint. He was shot and killed.
You know, I guess he's gone, but we were so in love. Like, but it was so good. But it was, you know, we were so happy. As if that was supposed to somehow negate the fact that he was gone. As if it was supposed to somehow not make it true.
I asked her if she thinks she'll ever love like that again.
No, never. Nope, that's impossible, I think. Well, and then he taught me, todo es posible, everything is possible. No love is anything but temporary. And even if it's the truest of true, of deepest love, it's inherently temporary.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. Those were indeed epic love stories. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, and a live audience of book lovers at the Public Library in Mill Valley, California.
And we're joined now by Troy Jalamore. He's a professor of philosophy at California State University, Chico. He's an award-winning poet, an author of two very fine books of poetry, but he's also author of the philosophical book, Love's Vision. Troy, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
Troy, you're a philosopher who wrote an entire book about love, this one right here. And you're also an award-winning poet. But you never write poetry about love. Why is that? What's wrong with you, huh?
Well, what's wrong with me? It's a large topic. I'll start with a small correction. I have published a couple of love poems. I rarely do. That is true. And I think the brief answer to that is because you write the poems you find that you can write. It's the same answer as why I don't write political poems. I try. And I try to write good love poems. They're just so hard.
But you can write philosophy books about love.
Their philosophy's easy.
So I'm going to turn our first substantive philosophical question over to Cole Porter. So, Troy, what is this thing called love?
Great question. Let me start by saying something quite obvious, which is it's an emotion, or at least in large part it is. And, of course, as soon as I say that, that makes people think about feelings. We have this tendency to talk about emotions like they're feelings. But really, there's a lot more involved in emotions than simple feelings, although they're certainly there. For me, and I'm heavily influenced here by Martha Nussbaum, well-known philosopher, I think that emotions are largely perceptions of value, valuable things in the world. Fear, for instance, to be afraid of something is to perceive it as bad and as dangerous to you.
But wait a minute. You say love is an emotion. Mm-hmm. But emotions are things that come and go. I'm angry for a moment, and then I'm not so angry. I'm elated, then I'm not so elated. You know, I'm ashamed of something I did, and it goes away. Love is the kind of thing that endures, or we hope it endures.
Right.
And we hope it endures. I mean, emotions don't seem the kind of thing that endure. They seem episodic.
Many emotions are like that, and especially, again, if you concentrate on the feeling aspect of them. But I think there's more to love than just the feeling, and I do think there's more to love than just the emotion. Love is, in part, also a commitment of will. You make certain decisions and shape your life in certain ways, in line with the emotions. It comes from and it's supported by that perception of value.
So let's just take a little inventory. So we think of ourselves as having minds, and the minds have various things going on. And there's emotions, which just kind of come very much laden with feelings. Then there's thoughts, beliefs. Then there's intentions. Now, you're saying love involves all of those. And it involves a certain characteristic feeling, also thoughts or perceptions or beliefs of value, and some intention, too. But are they all equal? Isn't it kind of really an emotion, and the other things just kind of come along to fill in around the corners?
Maybe so, in the sense that you could, I think, be in love for a short time and it could still be genuinely love. But I think that, especially when we think about love in its most ideal forms, we think of a longer-term thing. And there, it's very important, and I write about this in the book, that because these feelings do come and go, we can't rely on them to be rock solid all the time. We do have to make certain decisions to act in certain ways, even when you're not feeling it.
So I'm gonna challenge you after a bit, because it sounds to me like you started out saying love is an emotion, but now you just gave us a lot of reason to think maybe it's not essentially an emotion. But this is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mill Valley Public Library. The library is celebrating 100 years as this community's intellectual center. We're asking, what is this thing called love? With Troy Jalamore, author of Love's Vision.
Is love ever rational? And what role do reasons play in determining whom we love? And how does love affect our reason and our choices?
Love and rationality, along with questions from our audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
How I adored all her dear little stories, the gleam of her eyes in the telling. Before we devolved and our love was dissolved in clenched accusations, then yelling.
He's walking away like a man with a secret. He's walking away like a spy. He's walking away like a man who knows nothing except how to make love die.
Stop it. Stop it. Please just stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Please just stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Please just stop it. How I adored all her dear little stories as we sat in our small cafe.
Thanks to our musical guests, Amy and Merle Kessler, along with Joshua Raoul Brody. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and we're asking, what is love, with philosopher and poet Troy Jolamore. So, Troy, I want to get back to you. Said, so we were talking about whether love is an emotion. In the opening, John and I were talking about love as sometimes rational. We were saying there's a commitment and intentions. So it seems like a complicated stew. I want to push a little bit first on the is it subject to reasons part. Because look, here's an argument that love can't be about reasons. Suppose I love my wife for this, that, or that reason. Okay, here are my reasons. She's this, she's smart, she's beautiful, she's kind, she's good to animals, right? Suppose somebody, okay, those are my reasons. That's what justifies my loving her. Somebody else comes along with more of those qualities. Oh, shouldn't I love that person? And besides, if these reasons are good enough for me, why aren't they good enough for you? Why don't you love my wife, too? Because you're the reason she's lovable. It doesn't seem like it's about rationality and reasons.
Getting pretty kinky.
What do you think? Is love really about rationality and reasons? Because, you know, if it were...
Right. It really is. But we have to understand rationality and reasons correctly, which is the main goal, really, of the book. And you've just mentioned two problems that I discuss in the book, what I call the trading up problem. Why wouldn't you trade your partner up for somebody who's a little better? And the universe...
Or a lot better.
Or a lot better, right? Yeah. Well, people sometimes do that, but why shouldn't you if you love? And the universality problem, right? Why should I not love your wife if I accept your reasons for her good? And the first thing a philosopher does with a problem, of course, is to name them, which I've done, and already it seems like you've made some progress, so... The trading up problem in part, I mean, there's a lot to say about this, obviously, but part of the thing that we need to resist is the assumption, which I think is all too commonly made, and it's deep in our culture, that rationality always takes the form of what we can think of as economic rationality or self-interested rationality, where it's a matter of cold, objective calculation from a detached, neutral standpoint.
Well, that's the thing we were talking about in the opening. I said, right. Look, hey, here's a mule. Should I buy that mule or not?
Right.
Okay, it's really strong, it's sturdy, it doesn't eat that much. On the other hand, it's kind of slow and dumb. I balance it out. It doesn't seem as though you approach your love decisions that way.
No, and you shouldn't. That's right, because that's perfectly appropriate reasoning for appreciating the value of a mule.
But for a wife, you should say, is there a dowry? Does she have a good profession?
You could say that, but again, that's not really love.
Those arranged marriages work like that, but that's not love.
Arranged marriages are an interesting and complicated case, and I do think that you can learn to love somebody over time who you don't initially.
Okay, but wait a minute. So you rejected one kind of love as rational calculus kind of thing.
Right.
You reject that, but it sounds like you don't want to reject the idea that love can have some kind of rational...
Not at all. And you made the case yourself in the introduction where you talked about the reasons you do have for loving your wife. Rationality, though we've come to think about it this way, and reason, is not a cold, dispassionate process. I mean, think about morality or ethics, for instance, where people get very passionate about it, as well they should, but we also have reasons for acting in certain ways. And when we do moral philosophy, we're looking for the reasons some things are right and some things are wrong.
So you kind of presented love as a mixture of intention, cognition, and emotion. Yeah. Now, you might say, well, what you've described is a paradigm case, right? A case where a person has a feeling about another, they have the intention to spend time, support, and compliment that other in various ways, and they think good things about the other person. Now, often we have words for these situations when one or more of those things is missing. So maybe it'd help us if we thought about those words, like we have the word crush. Mm. That suggests the kind of case where you have an emotion that's really not supported by rational cognition and probably not right. Intention. You have the kind of situation like Anna Karenina with her husband where she seemed to think highly of him and seemed to have, at least at the beginning, the intention to stay with him, but something was missing the emotion. What do we call that?
What do we call that? That happens all the time. The question of a word for it is interesting. I mean, going back to the Ken's wife case, you know, if I appreciate...
Or, yeah, there's the emotion and the cognition, but for one reason or another, there's not really the intention.
Right. There it seems something has gone wrong, although the intention, as I suggested before, is often there to carry you through the periods where you're not really having the feeling spontaneously as you hope to. The case where you have the beliefs but not the emotional response. You believe that somebody is worthy of love, but you don't actually love them.
Do you,
I don't know if there is a word for that, but it happens all the time, obviously. Most of the people in my life, I think, are worthy of love.
Somebody's worthy of love. Okay, so this sounds like there can be suitable objects of love and unsuitable objects of love.
Yeah.
But somebody's worthy of love. That means, does that mean that, okay, here's a person with their qualities, I perceive their qualities, and it commands me. It just takes over and say, look, love me, I'm so lovable. Or is it that is it like my loving them is a response to something in them, or is it my loving them something just I do, kind of, you know what I mean?
It is a response, in my view. And it could feel like a command when it happens. I think it generally does. It feels like we have to. We don't see a person think, I could love her, and then decide to, and then it follows. At least not typically. Although there may be cases where you could try again in an arranged marriage. You might think, I could love her, I'm going to try to love her.
Okay, so it's not my undertaking to love somebody. It's
ordinarily.
Ordinarily, it's my just being compelled to love them.
Right. And again, I think many reasons work this way. We shouldn't think that makes it irrational. Reasons of belief often work that way. I can't help but believe that you're in front of me right now. It just happens. I can't choose not to. But I still have reasons to. In fact, the reasons are so good, that's why I couldn't choose not to.
I want to follow up on this arranged marriage. Now, in America, we're getting, because we have a lot of immigration from places where this is the custom, we now have, at least in the San Jose Bay Area, we have a lot of arranged marriages where the cultural conditions are not so different otherwise. So you can do some comparison. Statistically, I gather they do quite well. And, you know, it makes one wonder, well, maybe what you're describing, this paradigm involving emotions, maybe that's just kind of a Western romanticization of something that traditionally is divided into two things, this kind of infatuation, the emotion, and love of a man for a woman that typically isn't involved at the time of marriage and develops over time and is very cognitive. And that you, being a poet, it's not too surprising, have smushed them together in some kind of Western bastardization that you call romantic love. How do you feel about that?
I love being accused of smushing. That's what I do.
Yeah, can you smell it?
Yes, right. I think that I like the idea that in an arranged marriage, or at least in many, again, we're generalizing, it would be the other sort of, the more long-term sort of love and the commitment without the initial infatuation. That probably often happens. I think it's worth observing that in some sense, we do need to leave a lot of room in our view of love for accident and for will as well and for decision-making. In some sense, every marriage is an arranged marriage to a degree. That is, you don't meet everybody in the world. You don't go out and meet everyone and then decide which one you're going to love or something
like
that.
Well, you might say you most marriages are arranged by teenagers, but most marriages are engaged in by adults.
They're often arranged by circumstance of various sorts. And so within the constraints that we have, most of us, because love is so important to people, we do find ways to love the people that we're able to. Go ahead.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're at the Mill Valley Public Library talking with Troy Jalamore about the nature of love. And we're in front of an audience here, and we've got questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hello, my name is Rebecca. Speaking of rationality, I'd like to bring up the rationality behind the species and an essay by Schopenhauer entitled Love Between the Sexes, in which he completely deconstructs the process of two young people falling in love, and by the end of it, you're totally disabused of all of your romantic notions. And though he doesn't call it biological, because obviously Schopenhauer knew nothing about evolutionary biology, his point is to show that the entire point of it is the propagation of the next generation and a next fitter generation, and has absolutely nothing to do with the happiness or satisfaction of the individual, even though the individual, through their biology, is deluded into thinking so. And I'm just wondering if you could comment about that. And I'd just like to end, at a philosophy lecture at Berkeley, I heard the philosopher John Searle say that if you had never been taught anything about romantic love, you couldn't possibly do it.
Now, Troy, that's a complicated question now. What part of that question do you want to... I mean, you know, lots of people think culture, biology doesn't really care about these things that we do. As soon as we propagate and get the species gone, we're out of here. We're irrelevant. So this kind of deep romantic love thing, it's a thing to get us in bed together. But once we're in bed together, Evolution's done. As long as we stay together long enough for the kids to get reared and to get genes to get reproduced, but then it doesn't care.
Yeah. I want to take a view of that that I think is realistic but also somewhat optimistic. That is, I think it's a false dilemma to say there is this evolutionary explanation of love, therefore that's all it's about and it can't make us happy or something like that. I think the evolutionary explanation of love is true and clear, and that's essentially what we are. We're biological creatures. That said, I think that for reasons that we can understand, which biologists help us understand, we have these capacities to love that can make us happy. Now, are they guaranteed to? No.
But the thing that evolution can't explain is our commitment to lifelong love. Because look, evolution is about reproductive success. Men have a lot longer reproductive lifespan than women.
Right.
So why should there be, if you look at it from an evolutionary point of view, why should there be lifelong love?
Right. There, I believe that it is because we have gotten through evolution, which has given us the ability to do many things that don't have an evolutionary advantage, you know, higher math and so on. We've gotten the ability to appreciate certain values, including the value of human individuals. And so we understand part of loving someone for your whole life is understanding what's so amazing about them that you want to stay.
The biological importance of food isn't too hard to understand, and that we would have evolved to eat as opposed to just starving to death. But there's a lot that doesn't explain, like why food is so good, and you know why French food is so much more interesting than British food, and so forth and so on. So I mean, Schopenhauer was a bit of a grouch, and he was onto something new. Look, some of these basic things that philosophers go on and on about have a biological explanation, a biological partial explanation. Mm. But he needed to loosen up.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man. What's your comment or question?
Well, here's some things I've noticed. You must be in love to get married in this culture. There are a lot of marriages in which there is no love anymore, but they stay together. But if you fall out of love, people say, you can't get divorced just for falling out of love. So how important is love in marriage? Because when marriage was originally created, it wasn't really about love at all.
You know, but the question is, I think that's an important question, but I think the prior question really is, what is love? If love is an emotion, and if it's a response to the qualities of this or that in the way that you seem to think, then, you know, if you no longer feel that emotion, if you no longer have that response, then you say you don't love the person anymore, and why are you there? But if love is an undertaking, a commitment to another, commitments are things that can stand when your feelings about them wax and wane, right? And a marriage is not just a theater, it's a theater of a commitment. And that's what, look, take you in your book, you bracket love for family, right? Mm-hmm. But take my son, you know, sometimes he drives me crazy, you know? And I imagine if he were somebody else's son, don't listen to this son. If he were somebody else's son, I might not think, oh, there's the greatest kid ever, right? But I have this orientation toward him that is not dependent upon, you know, the local this or that or the other thing. And that's my love for him, that it's independent of those things. And the love in a marriage is, I don't think it's just this momentary state of elation. It's this deep commitment, this undertaking to be with another person.
Sure.
That makes it very different from perception.
No, I think that the perception helps explain why it is that way, because I agree with almost everything that you said. And I think about your son, for instance. You're not wrong about your son. Your son has the values that you see him as having, but because of your relationship with him, you're in a better position to perceive those values than I or almost anybody else. So you appreciate things about him that other people would miss because of that love relationship.
Know things about him that other people would miss that drive me crazy, too.
That's true, too. You're absolutely right about that. And love can be a double-edged sword that way. But I do think the importance of commitment and relationship, as much as you're describing, and it literally affects the way we perceive people, which is why I say in the book that love is a type of perception.
Another question from our audience here at Mill Valley Public Library. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Until you raised the point about your son, the conversation seemed to me to be almost entirely, in fact, was entirely, except for the introduction, about romantic love, which is to say between romantic partners. I wonder if you could speak about the love that friends have for each other, or perhaps the love that an individual may have for Christ, or if they're not Christian, for God, for some spiritual being, where there is, they use the word love, so could you address that, perhaps?
Sure.
Thank you.
There's a couple things I want to say very quickly about that, and One is that in the book, I begin by saying that I'm only going to address love between persons, although we use the word love, obviously, in a lot of other contexts. And there are some things I think make love between persons very special and unique, including the idea that when you love a person, unlike, say, when you love Chinese food or music or something, you're loving something that can love you back. And that introduces a lot of very interesting complications. But I do say a lot about friendship. And in fact, my first book was about friendship. It interests me greatly. My view, which is, I think, right, but not necessarily common, is that friendship and romantic love are much more closely related than most people tend to think of them as being. Romantic love is basically a kind of friendship love, I think. And friends are very much like romantic lovers with one element missing, but most of the rest is there. You know, people talk about friends with benefits these days, but being a friend always has benefits, and it's very much the same kind of benefits that you have in a romantic relationship. I actually think there's something very romantic about the relationship between two very close friends.
So I think we're going to, I want to dig into that. Those are some good and important questions and raise some hard issues. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking, what is love? With Troy Drollimore, author of Love's Vision.
What part does love play in a well-lived life? What's wrong with a life without love? Anything?
We're coming to you from the Mill Valley Public Library. The library is celebrating 100 years as this community's intellectual center. We'll hear more from Troy and take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Your back is too hairy.
That smile's a bit scary.
That's a deal breaker. Long walks on the beach.
Blonde? No, that's bleach.
That's a deal breaker. Candlelight dinners,
just not a winner.
That's a deal breaker. You want a chick flick?
I think zombies are groovy.
That's a deal breaker.
For your own sake, put a break on your quibbles. Love is a cake, why not take a nibble? Relax, take a look. Not the cover, the book. Maybe love will make a deal with you.
If the sniper and quaker,
slacker and shaker,
if True Blue hooks up with an absolute faker,
maybe love will make a deal.
Maybe love will make a deal.
Maybe love will make a deal with you.
Merle and Amy Kessler with Joshua Raoul Brody. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're here with poet and philosopher Troy Drollimore asking the question, what is love? Troy, I want to go back to one of the unsolved problems, what you call the trading up problem. Mm. You know, this is Socrates' big argument. Why you can't love, the object of love is not really any particular individual, not this, because there's nothing to distinguish this individual from that individual in terms of beauty. Your true object of love is love itself. If you start out seeking reasons to love, beauty itself, you're going to end up loving the highest thing which commands love is beauty, and individual is going to appear. So you said, you granted this was a problem, mm-hmm. that, you know, I love my wife for this or that reason. Somebody exemplifies that to a higher degree. Right? Why shouldn't I love that person? If it's a response to the qualities, then why shouldn't I respond to the qualities most present in the person who has them most? So you said you had a solution to this. I didn't hear it. What's your solution to this trading up problem?
Yeah, the core of the solution, as I see it, goes back to something I actually did say, but it went over very quickly, which was there are different modes of appreciation that are appropriate for different valuable things. It's appropriate in many contexts to take that kind of detached, impartial standpoint and compare things with each other and so on. And there's no deficiency in the way that you value those economic goods if you do that. If it's persons that you're appreciating or loving or valuing, and you're doing it as persons, not just as tools or employees or something like that, you know, we could imagine those contexts where it might be appropriate. But loving people as persons, romantic lovers, friends, whatever it is, that kind of comparative thought just isn't an appropriate mode of valuing. It's inappropriate to the object.
Why not? Look, I'm shopping around for somebody to love. Don't I want the most lovable, most the person
sure.
I would be best with, the sure. person I would be best for?
So, I mean, now with these internet dating sites, the shopping is pretty up front. I mean, is there something wrong with that whole system?
No, and especially in the early stages, a certain degree of that is fine. When you are not attached to anybody yet and you're looking around, mm-hmm. sure, it would be insane to say to somebody, be blind to the fact that this person will make you happy and this person almost certainly won't be.
So you could go over the deal breakers.
Wait a minute. Absolutely. You use this phrase, which you use in your book, love mm-hmm. is blind. So yes. You think to love someone, tell me if I got this right, mm-hmm. to love someone, to plop down for this person as your beloved, mm-hmm. is to commit yourself or to actually blind yourself to the attractions of any other. Is that right?
To a degree, I think that happens. Again, it's not exactly something you do to yourself in the voluntary sense. It happens when you fall in love with someone, whether you want it to or not. But it is perspectival in that way. It's a perception, again, and perception is always a matter of perspective. So I see you, meaning right now I can't see John.
So if I love this person, I'm mm-hmm. focused on this person,
right.
and my focus on this person blinds me to the other,
right.
and that being blind to the other is what makes it possible for me to love this person. Because if I weren't blind to the other, all these competing reasons would be rushing in on me.
Yeah, you could never appreciate the value of a human individual if you didn't focus on them. Focus is essential.
But now we know from biochemistry, as I understand it, that actually some of the centers of the brain kind of shut down when you're in love.
That
produce this kind of thing. Does that make it irrational or objectionable, or does that just show that our brain has some sense of romance?
I would prefer to say the latter. That's right. It looks irrational if we come at it from a self-interested perspective and think that this is about making me as an individual as happy as possible. But even there, we should say that in the long run, a person who can be less critical and attach themselves, the song suggests this, right, may be likely to be happier than the person who is always looking to trade up.
Yeah, I take your point, but it sounds like this. Okay, you say you love me, dude. And you say, in order for me to keep loving you, I better block all these other people out. Because if I compared you to everybody else, I'd say, oh, God, what am I doing with you? Oh, my God. That sounds the opposite of romantic. I mean, isn't true love when I could see the beauties of all the others, the attraction of all the others, and I say, still, I choose you.
Well, that would be wonderful, but realistically, I mean, it's unlikely. I'm just not the best-looking guy around, and only one of us is, whoever that may be. So,
we've got a question from our audience here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
As I've been listening to the thoughts that you've been sharing, a couple of points have been consistent throughout. One is that love seems to be about relationship. I want to love someone else and be loved by them. And the other is that it's for some benefit, whether it's biological or financial or whatever, which leaves me wondering about what unrequited love is, or love from afar. I'm not talking about the one that you see the cute girl at the bar and forget about an hour later. I'm thinking about that sort of person who's been obsessing with someone for a long time but never quite gets together or sees that person, gets rejected, and can't put it away. Is that love? And if so, what's the benefit for it? Why is that person doing that?
I don't think we said anything about love is for like a benefit like financial or anything like that. I don't think your view implies that. I don't think I believe that. Moreover, we've been talking about romantic love, which is typically reciprocal. Otherwise, it's kind of desperate and sad. But look, you can love your children and they can be utter shoots to you. I don't think I can say it with an I. They can be utter shoots, yet you still love them. You can love them, and you love your children. You don't expect... I don't know how many children you have, but you don't expect until they get to be, 20, 30, 40, they even realize the possibility that they might love their parents in return. And that seems actually, you see, you think of romantic love as the paradigm of love. I actually think of love of one's love where you expect no return. It's a pure giving to the other as more paradigmatic. I don't know.
I think that romantic love can be that way. I'm happy to admit the possibility of unrequited love. And I do think love typically has benefits, but they're not necessary, and we don't love in order to get benefits, but they are typically involved. But could there be a case of romantic love where there's no benefit of that sort? Sure, absolutely, and I don't see any reason for not calling it love. Some philosophers would say it has to be a relationship, it has to be returned to be love. I don't hold to that view.
To get at the benefits of love, let's go through the question about that is kind of the core to this part of our story. What would life without love, a life devoid of love, be like? Would that be a life worthy of a human being? I mean, or is some love is loving something or someone somehow? Well, is that essential to our lives?
Let's focus the question. I mean, just what you're talking about, love of another person, right? Because, you know, you can imagine people that are dedicated to, you know, truth,
justice,
beauty, mathematics. But if they have all that, they have maybe a satisfying life because they proved a theorem. Still, if they don't love anyone, are they missing something?
Are they missing something?
I mean, something really essential, crucial, so they're really only living. They're really not living a quality human life.
They're certainly not living, I mean, a full human life. You know, Aristotle asks the question, right? He makes the statement, no one would choose to live without friends. But of course, in a way, that's ambiguous. You know, what is my choice here that I'm imagined to be faced with? Is it, what are the alternatives? Is he saying, you can live with friends or without them, which one do you want? Or is he saying, you can live without friends or not live at all, which one do you want? Mm. I would say that certainly I would choose to live with friends rather than without them, because you'd be missing something huge if you didn't have it. But faced with the choice between a friendless life or no life at all, I would choose life without personal love, although it would be sadly diminished.
It would be sadly, look, I'll tell you a little bit about my theory of love. I haven't written a book about it, but I have a theory. The love of a person is to take them as what I call another self, another self for you. Here's a person who has a self, who is a self-conscious, reflective being with goals and desires of their own. To love that person, I don't think it's an emotion, but it's to have this attitude toward them, that your self is a self for me. Your hurting is hurting for me. Your happiness is happiness for me, so that I endow my selfhood into you. And that's why love is so cool, because it connects us in this deep way to other human selves.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I'm a bit leery of going as far as one might with the unity view of saying, you know, you really become the other person in a literal sense or anything close. But connection, I think, is very important.
I'm a little worried about the wine snob phenomenon here. I mean, wine's a fine thing. You like wine. Some wines are better than others. End of story. Oh, no. Whole big hullabaloo about this, that, and the other, body odor, taste, and so forth. So love is fine, you know. There's sex, there's friendship, there's children, there's commitment. It's great. End of story. Oh no, you got a self and another self.
Yeah, well, but that's what
you read Kant at too early an age.
That's what unifies them all. Well, maybe we've got another. Well, probably last question that we'll take. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm having a little trouble with philosophy meeting love. I think that philosophy is love of wisdom. I don't know if it's love of love. I'll tell you something that impressed me. It had to do with an Italian sociologist who wrote a book called Falling in Love. And in that, he makes a neat distinction between falling in love and the other forms of love. And he says that falling in love is, to a person, what a revolution is to a country. And you need a couple of things for that to happen. Number one, you need, of course, a leadership of some sort, of some idea that's counter what's going on. But you need to have a country that's in some disarray. You can't have a revolution that something's wrong with that person. Now, it doesn't have to be devastating. They don't have to be destitute. But somewhere in the tremendous complexity of who each of us are, there are ways that we miss things, that we are missing things, that we can't see things. And invariably, we see them outside ourselves when we can't see them in ourselves, and we see them in other people. And so someone comes along and they offer us something without our being aware of it that is missing in our country, which has become destitute for one reason or another. People are unique. The way people come together is through myriads of contacts. No two loves are like any other. So can you factor that in, the very specific definitions of two people being in love in the way no other two people can be in love?
Well, I think the analogy of a revolution is very apt, because there's all kinds of revolutions. They have a few things in common. Like you say, there's some dissatisfaction, there's some flaws in the way things are done, but then they're radically different in all sorts of ways, and some work out well, but most of them flop. So I think there's a lot of analogies there.
Something you said that toward the end of your remarks, people are so different. So this one of the things I think love is really about, and this kind of goes with your story, is seeing the other in their full particularity.
Absolutely.
I mean, in most places, I'm a role, right? In my classroom, I'm the professor. I have my particular style, and my students appreciate my particular style. But my friends and my family and my wife, they see me in my full particularity, the warts and us all, and they somehow accept it. Mm. Not only accept it, celebrate it.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the things that we really value about love.
Yes.
The seeing the other and being seen by the other in our full particularity.
It does connect you with other people in that way. Love is the cure for solipsism. I think that is really true at the end of the day.
So on that note, Troy, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a lovely conversation.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Troy Jalamore. He's a professor of philosophy from California State University, Chico. He's an award-winning poet, and he's author of the philosophy book Love's Vision. So, John, what are you thinking today?
Well, I think this romantic love idea is very interesting. I've been thinking, going back to this idea that it's schmoozing together several different things that don't have to go together. But, you know, if you were a visitor from some other time and you looked at our concept, so they say, of a free, enlightened citizen, you might have that same reaction. You might say, oh, wait, you're taking, what's appropriate for a slave, namely working, what's appropriate for this, namely deciding. And you put this together in this kind of Western schmoozing of a free and rational human being that does all of these things. Just doesn't work, makes no sense. And then the other attitude is, no, it's a great discovery. It's a great discovery, the enlightenment that each individual, not just a special class or a special case, can have all of these attributes. And so maybe Troy is the enlightenment philosopher for love, that romantic love isn't just a kind of mirage. It's an insight into human possibilities. Well, and we ought to strive for it.
And that's a very good thought, and we'll have to continue thinking about this. And the way we'll continue the thinking about this is on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can also follow us on Twitter and on our very active Facebook page.
We have a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk, and you can get that at our website, philosophytalk.org. For the final word, we turn to the world's fastest talking lover, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, love is a mixed proposition. For every comedy that ends with our happy couple making goo-goo eyes at the altar, there's another that ends with an argument at 2 a.m., make-up sex, one final argument, and all your personal belongings thrown into the hallway. Been there, done that. Love in and of itself is boring unless you're in it. Fortunately for us, we are peculiar. We go out of our way to embrace the horrible love stories, and our history is full of them, both in real life and the arts. The Greek and Roman gods were always either punishing or pitying mortals in love. The gods would get so mad that certain humans wouldn't go to bed with them. They'd turn them into spiders and small bugs. The gods would get so moved when some mortal's yearning was so strong and made them die, they'd turn them into stars and breezes. So basically, punishment and pity were pretty much the same thing. That's the gods for you, and love. Echo and Narcissus, Paris and Helen. That didn't really work out, did it? Heloise and Abelard. He wound up being castrated by her relatives, and she finished out her days as a bitter yet competent nun. Troilus and Cressida, Tristan and Isolde. He didn't even want to fall in love. It was that damn potion. Antony and Cleopatra, Lancelot and Guinevere. That little fling brought down Camelot. Hadn't been for them, we might all be living under a highly benevolent monarchy today. There are Heathcliff and Catherine in Wuthering Heights. Well, Jane Eyre ends happily, I guess, with her marrying a broody, one-eyed blind man. Then there's Buffy and Angel. If only they'd met before the Twilight series began, Buffy and Angel could have married, had a baby, and done battle with a jealous werewolf. There's Annis and Jack from Brokeback Mountain, Marilyn Monroe, and, well, she never did find love, did she? Liz and Eddie, Liz and Dick, and they made Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a movie about those goo-goo-eyed kids at the altar 30 years later. You don't see happily married old people in movies. If you do, they're usually there to get killed by bad guys, giving the hero an excuse to blow them up with a high-tech bazooka in the last reel. We had Bonnie and Clyde, Martin and Lewis, Abbott and Costello, the one-sided love of John Hinckley for Jodie Foster. Nowadays, there's the Kardashian marriage fiasco. And poor Jennifer Aniston. Whoever shall she find? She's so hungry for love, so think us. Well, I don't know about that. Many times bitten majorly shy, I'd think, when it comes to Ms. Aniston. Why would you want love in the first place? Love is play Misty for me. Love is fatal attraction. It's all going to end with the queen clutching an asp to her bosom as the Romans close in. That being said, Ms. Aniston, may I call you Jennifer? I am available if you don't mind dating a broke narcissist with a few issues and his personal belongings strewn all over the hallway. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2011. Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Joshua Raul Brody. Special thanks to the Mill Valley Library Foundation, along with the friends and the residents of Mill Valley for supporting this great library. Also thanks to Angie Brenner, Sean Mooney, Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman. Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates. The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders. The conversation continues on the website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
So I want to talk today about money and happiness, which are two things that a lot of us spend a lot of our time thinking about, either trying to earn them or trying to increase them. And a lot of us resonate with this phrase, so we see it in religions and self-help books, that money can't buy happiness. And I want to suggest today that, in fact, that's wrong, and that I'm at a business school, so that's what we do, so that's wrong. And in fact, if you think that, you're actually just not spending it right, so that instead of spending it the way you usually spend it, maybe if you spent it differently, that might work a little bit better. And before I tell you the ways that you can spend it that will make you happier, let's think about the ways we usually spend it that don't, in fact, make us happier. We had a little natural experiment. So CNN a little while ago wrote this interesting article on what happens to people when they win the lottery. It turns out people think when they win the lottery, their lives are going to be amazing. This article is about how their lives get ruined. So what happens when people win the lottery is, number one, they spend all the money and go into debt. And number two, all of their friends and everyone they've ever met find them and bug them for money. And it ruins their social relationships, in fact. So they have more debt and worse friendships than they had before they won the lottery. What was interesting about the article was people started commenting on the article, readers of the thing. And instead of talking about how it had made them realize that money doesn't lead to happiness, everyone instantly started saying, you know what I would do if I won the lottery? And fantasizing about what they do. And here's just two of the ones that we saw that are just really interesting to think about. One person wrote in, when I win, I'm going to buy my own little mountain and have a little house on top. And another person wrote, I would fill a big bathtub with money and get in the tub while smoking a big fat cigar and sipping a glass of champagne. This is even worse now. Then I'd have a picture taken and dozens of glossies made. Anyone begging for money or trying to extort from me would receive a copy of the picture and nothing else. And so many of the comments were exactly of this type, where people got money, and in fact, it made them antisocial. So I told you that it ruins people's lives and that their friends bug them. It also, money often makes us feel very selfish and we do things only for ourselves. And we said, well, maybe the reason that money doesn't make us happy is that we're always spending it on the wrong things, and in particular, that we're always spending it on ourselves. And we thought, I wonder what would happen if we made people spend more of their money on other people. So instead of being antisocial with your money, what if you were a little bit more pro-social with your money? And we thought, let's make people do it and see what happens. So let's have some people do what they usually do and spend money on themselves, and let's make some people give money away and measure their happiness and see if, in fact, they get happier. So the first way that we did this on one Vancouver morning, we went out on the campus at University of British Columbia, and we approached people and said, do you want to be in an experiment? And they said yes. We asked them how happy they were, and then we gave them an envelope. And one of the envelopes had things in it that said, by 5 p.m. today, spend this money on yourself. So we gave some examples of what you could spend it on. Other people in the morning got a slip of paper that said, by 5 p.m. today, spend this money on somebody else. Also inside the envelope was money, and we manipulated how much money we gave them. So some people got this slip of paper and $5. Some people got this slip of paper and $20. We let them go about their day. They did whatever they wanted to do. We found out that they did, in fact, spend it in the way that we asked them to. We called them up at night and asked them, what'd you spend it on, and how happy do you feel now? What did they spend it on? Well, these are college undergrads, so a lot of what they spent it on for themselves was things like earrings and makeup. One woman said she bought a stuffed animal for her niece. People gave money to homeless people. Huge effect here of Starbucks. So if you give undergraduates $5, it looks like coffee to them, and they run over to Starbucks and spend it as fast as they can. But some people bought a coffee for themselves the way they usually and I gave her this money. This isn't $10,000, it's the local currency. So it's a very small amount of money, in fact. But enormously different motivations here. This is a real medical need, literally a life-saving donation. Above, it's just kind of, I bought a gift for my mother. What we see again, though, is that the specific way that you spend on other people is different there for some reason or another. Just below that to the right is Rwanda, though, which is amazingly green. So almost everywhere we look, we see that giving money away makes you happier than keeping it for yourself. What about your work life, which is where we spend all the rest of our time when we're not with the people we know? We decided to infiltrate some companies and do a very similar thing. So these are sales teams in Belgium. They work in teams. They go out and sell basically to doctors and try to get them to buy drugs. So we can look to see how well they sell things as a function of being a member of a team. Some teams, we give people on the team some money for themselves and say, spend it however you want on yourself, just like we did with the undergrads in Canada. But other teams, we say, here's 15 euro. Spend it on one of your teammates this week. Buy them something as a gift or a present and give it to them. And then we can see, now we've got teams that spend on themselves and we've got these pro-social teams who we give money to make the team a little bit better. The reason I have a ridiculous pinata there is one of the teams pulled their money and bought a pinata and they all got around and smashed the pinata and all the candy fell out and things like that. A very silly, trivial thing to do, but think of the difference on a team that didn't do that at all, that got 15 euro, put it in their pocket, maybe bought themselves a coffee, or teams that had this pro-social experience where they all bonded together to buy something and do a group activity. What we see is that, in fact, the teams that are pro-social sell more stuff than the teams that only got money for themselves. And one way to think about it is, for every 15 euro you give people for themselves, they put it in their pocket, they don't do anything different than they did before, you don't get any money from that. You actually lose money because it doesn't motivate them to perform any better. But when you give them 15 euro to spend on their teammates, they do so much better on their teams that you actually get a huge win on investing this kind of money. And I realize that you're probably thinking to yourselves, this is all fine, but there's a context that's incredibly important for public policy, and I can't imagine it would work there. And if he doesn't show me that it works here, I don't believe anything he said. And I know that what you're all thinking about are dodgeball teams. This was a huge criticism that we got, you know, to say, if you can't show with dodgeball teams, this is all stupid. So we went out and found these dodgeball teams and infiltrated them, and we did the exact same thing as before. So some teams we give people on the team money, they spend it on themselves. Other teams we give them money to spend on their dodgeball teammates. The teams that spent money on themselves, they're just the same winning percentage as they were before. The teams that we give the money to spend on each other, they become different teams, and in fact, they dominate the league by the time they're done. Across all of these different contexts, your personal life, your work life, even silly things like intramural sports, we see spending on other people has a bigger return for you than spending on yourself. And so I'll just say, I think if you think money can't buy happiness, you're not spending it right. The implication is not, you know, you should buy this product instead of that product, and that's the way to make yourself happier. It's in fact that you should stop thinking about which product to buy for yourself and try giving some of it to other people instead. And we luckily have an opportunity for you. DonorsChoose.org is a nonprofit for mainly public school teachers in low-income schools. They post projects, so they say, I want to teach Huckleberry Finn to my class and we don't have the books, or I want a microscope to teach my students science and we don't have a microscope. You and I can go on and buy it for them. The teacher writes you a thank you note. The kids write you a thank you note. Sometimes they send you pictures of them using the microscope. It's an extraordinary thing. Go to the website and start yourself on the process of thinking, again, less about how can I spend money on myself and more about if I've got $5 or $15, what can I do to benefit other people? Because ultimately when you do that, you'll find out you'll benefit yourself much more. Thank you.
WHFR, Dearborn.
What if it wasn't always about getting ahead? What if you didn't care about being on the fast track? What if your career goals were to change? Instead of flying off to the big interview, what if you flew somewhere else altogether? To improve.